welcome back to another episode of the Catholic Buzz, our 20th episode. Thank you for journeying with us for 20 episodes and keeping us on the air, really, because we've been having fun here answering all sorts of different questions and topics about the Catholic faith. And thank you for continuing to give us your feedback and ask your questions and also your thanks. We're getting a lot of thanks, and it's just about starting the conversation, and so thank you for doing that. But I don't do it alone. My name is Father Daniele, and I'm always joined by the two most knowledgeable people I know, and it's Josh Sullivan. Josh, welcome to
Hello.
You.
Hello, how are you doing?
Good, how are you?
I'm doing good. You've been gone for the last couple of weeks.
No, I've been back now.
Oh, you're back now. That's right, I mean, you're back now.
I'm back now, yeah, exactly. You can see me now, look at me.
Yeah. But you were out of town.
I was out of town. Yeah, this weekend I was back in town, though, because...
Oh, yeah, it was last weekend.
Yeah, it was last weekend.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, we just haven't seen each other since then.
I know, it seems so long.
Funny story about our partner over here, Matt Van Milligan. I'm exiting the church on Sunday and coming out to begin Mass, and there's Matt with his son in the bush of the church, like this bush around the church, and I went, what is Matt doing in the bush? And he was just supervising his child as... He went to the bathroom in the bush.
Yeah, I was wondering how you were going to say, because I was going to specify that he was the one actually peeing in the bush.
Not you.
I was just running defense on people walking by.
Yes. Yeah. I'm glad I clarified it. People didn't think you were the one peeing in the bush.
I mean, what are you supposed to do during COVID when the bathrooms are closed?
See the bathroom? That's exactly what Matt told me.
That's... That's the excuse anyway. But
it's just a lot
we
easier.
We live in the bush, so, you know, and three boys. This is just part of...
But, all joking aside, your kids do run free and sort of, you have lots of property there at your place. And that's beautiful. What a way to grow up. Mm-hmm. Well, because did you grow up the same way, sort of running free?
Sometimes yes, sometimes no. We moved around a lot. So sometimes we had a bit of space. Sometimes we didn't.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
You did.
Yeah.
You grew up.
Yeah. Well, I grew up in the city until I was in about grade 8, and then we moved out to the country. And so then my teenage years, we're out in the field all the time. And
right.
The rule kind of a thumb, so from the country boy, is if there is a space where you can do it privately, then you go ahead. So my boys just moving out to the country now.
They have so much space now.
They asked. They're just like, so can we... pee in the bush, or do we have to come inside? And I'm like, well, how far are you from the house? They're like, well, if we're just outside. I was like, just outside, and I'm gonna step in it? No, you can't.
Yeah.
But if you're out in the field and I have to yell at you, he's like, just, you know, where no one can see you, just go and pick a tree and, you know.
I love how we started this episode talking about this topic, because it can only go down from here. Yeah, I don't know. That's so funny. It is our 20th episode. Congratulations on 20 episodes. Mm-hmm. We started back in earlier during like the COVID lockdown, when I think it was at the time when you could only go to your house or the grocery store.
Yeah.
But I think by that time, like Canadian Tire and stuff had opened.
We had five people in a room only.
Yeah, it was only about five.
Because we had to make sure
we
limited our crew.
Five.
Exactly. We had to limit everyone.
Yeah. And that's another thing. Kevin and Dave, who work behind the camera for all 20 episodes.
Have been here every time,
And they put up with so much garbage from us, eh?
They really do.
They really do. They have the patience and the of saints. They do. They're like, let's get started. And we're like,
what about this?
I
want to talk about pee for a little bit longer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Can we talk about Matt's kid peeing in the bush at church? So for our 20th episode, just before we go there, our 19th episode, when we talked about Father Matt Hood and the validity of sacraments, started a great conversation.
Yep.
Like everywhere I went this week, people were asking me about it and wondering. And you know, we were like, don't worry about your sacraments if they're valid. Yeah. People are worried about this.
Of course.
Yeah. The people are like, how do I find out if mine is valid? Remember, the church presumes your sacraments to be valid unless there's proof otherwise right? Don't worry about that. But it did start a great conversation.
Yeah.
Our 20th episode, we've been asked to do another speed round. And that's when people send us their questions that we've collected over a long time. When was our last speed round? I think our 10th episode.
Yeah, somewhere I don't think we did it for 15.
I think this is our third speed round, right?
Yeah. So it's been 10 episodes since our last speed round. You know the rules. Some of these questions need a more lengthy response and more attention. But we're going to try and give a 2-minute talk, and I think we have a timer going somewhere for 2 minutes, and maybe
I'll keep an eye on the clock.
You'll keep an eye on the clock.
I'll make.
Did you forget the bell?
I did forget the
bell. You forgot the bell this week, this time. So people have sent us their questions.
Yep.
We're going to try and broach them and answer them as quickly as we can. And we'll see how we do. We always have fun with this.
Yeah, for sure.
There's always a mix of questions. Matt, are you ready?
I am. Yeah, with the caveat that the goal here is to A, have fun, and B, start the conversation on a lot of these things.
Because exactly.
2 minutes is never
enough. Not a lot of time to answer enough. Some of this.
Yeah. Especially because in the past we've been getting like rich questions.
Yeah, oh yeah.
I know.
Yeah.
So I hope you're ready. I hope you have your coffee there.
Yeah, I'm all set. I'm well caffeinated.
Yeah. All right. I'm looking for a good one to open up. Let's see.
Well, that's always a good sign.
Okay. Do you have pointers on how to ask for intercessions from Mary and saints, etc., without falling into worship?
Good question.
Yeah, great question. I think what I would say for worship versus, so adoration and worship are for God alone, whereas in asking them, so realizing that the power doesn't come from Mary or the saints, but they can pray for you just like you would ask your parents or you would ask your brother or sister or your friend or your priest. So if you're talking to Mary and the saints in prayer that way, and that's how kind you would direct the conversation, not say, Mary, in your all majesty power, can you, you know, she has no power. Her power comes, she has no power. God is the one that does it because Mary's asked.
That's how I see it. I see it as, you know, the communion of saints, like this friendship with people who are in the presence of God right now in heaven. And so we have sort of a friendly relationship with them. And we ask them, like, I would you a favor, you know, to pray for me, to intercede for me, to help me out. Just like you ask a friend a favor. It's much different than when you're praying to Jesus, knowing that he's God,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It is a very fine line, though. Like, there is a, I feel like people, depending on devotions and everything else, too, can fall into that. There's been devotions and prayers that I've picked up and read, and I've said, like, just because it's on a piece of paper doesn't mean it's legit from the Catholic Church, right? But I've had those and said, okay, this is not okay. Like, this prayer right here is not okay. And then crumpled it up and thrown it out or whatever the case may be, because it's asking for the power through the person that it's asking, not necessarily through God. Like, Mary, instead of Mary, ask your son for this, it's you, whatever, you know?
But when people intercede, it's really prompting the Lord to grant it for us.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, so to come back to the question itself, what's the pointer? I think the pointer is to, the same way you would ask anyone for intercession. This is how you approach the saints. But I think there are some legitimate prayers and that have addresses at the beginning that say, Mary, because of your relationship to God, like those are the ones that you would want to follow, because they make appeal not to Mary's, you know, specific power, but her specific relationship to Jesus, and that's why we're turning to her for her intercession.
I think it's fantastic.
Yeah.
We always end a great question when Matt has the final word.
That's right. I like it.
You know? Yeah. Okay, we're going to start the 2 minutes now.
Okay, two minutes.
Yeah, I have it.
Okay. Why do we make the sign of the cross on our forehead, lips, and chest before we read the gospel at Mass? Good question. Yeah.
That's a good question.
It's really funny because I don't know if people realize or remember that that's what we're supposed to do. I don't think I was ever taught that except through my parents. So there was no class that I went to that told me I was supposed to do the sign of the cross here, here, and here.
Yeah, so we're talking just before the gospel is proclaimed.
Yeah.
The deacon or the priest says, the Lord be with you.
And with
a reading
spirit.
From the Holy Gospel according to Matthew. We say, glory to you, O Lord.
And
we
everyone
trace
does,
the sign of the
does some hand movements over their face.
Yeah. But you're right. Maybe people learn it by watching, but it is actually a tracing of the sign of the cross on your forehead, over your lips, and the question says chest. I think it's over
chest,
your heart.
Yeah, yeah.
Really?
There's words to go along with that too, right?
Well,
Lord, be on my mind, be on my lips, be on my heart.
Right. So we're actually saying glory to you, O Lord, as we're doing it. But that's exactly what it's for. That the gospel I'm about to hear, that the Lord may enter my mind, may be on my lips to proclaim his word, and enter my heart. That I'm really focusing myself to hear the gospel for this day. Right? And I think anything to add to that?
Yeah, that's really good.
Yeah.
Is that a lot of times, and again, this isn't a two-minute thing, that people kind of separate, you know, head and heart. That it's like intellectual knowledge versus like emotions or feelings, mm-hmm. or that like these are separate things. That but the Gospels and all kind of theology should properly make appeal to your thoughts,
to
your heart, and you know there should be some expression or response there from your mouth. And it throws back to Deuteronomy 6: the love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, all your mind, and all your strength. So there's a kind of a long kind of tradition there. There's a real continuity in that being expressed in the Mass.
True. That was a 2 minute
on the
that
nose.
Was a 2 minute sound. That scared okay. me. I didn't know where that sound was coming from.
Okay, yeah. Good.
But yes, so we're asking that the gospel we're going to hear changes our mind, affects our heart, and is proclaimed by our lips. Yeah, Deuteronomy 6. That's great.
And then people realize that we actually are forming a little cross on your forehead, forming it on your lips, and putting it on your heart.
Yes, and trace it. People are like just kind of, you know.
Yeah. Well, my son, who's 7 years old, did it today at Mass. On Sunday at Mass, and that's when we were. I was like, okay, whoa, you're not doing it right. This is what you're supposed to do.
Yeah.
But that was earlier this week, and so that's that's kind of fresh for me too.
Remember when your kids were baptized too? You traced the sign of the cross on their forehead. The priest blesses them close to the heart with the oil of catechumens, and he also blesses their mouth and their ears. Hear. So there's a connection to our baptism there too.
Yeah.
We went over that.
Okay.
The time limit there.
Yeah. Here's the next one. Are there different kinds of Catholicism?
Oh yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. That's a really good one, because that was something that was maybe a bit strange or unknown to me coming into the church, because you hear Catholic, or like the most common that you hear is Roman Catholic. So it's like, are only Roman Catholics Catholic? Are there Catholicisms beyond that? And the answer is yes. There are a number of, it's wrong to say churches, but there are a number of groups within Catholicism proper, is probably the better way of saying that. And that's 20, 21, 23, I forget the specific groups, and some of them are very, very small. But the thing that unites them, or the thing that makes it proper to refer to them as the church, is that they are all in communion on core essentials of the Catholic faith. Mm-hmm. So you have ones that are well known are kind of Byzantine denominations like Ukrainian Catholic. There are Coptic Catholics. Mm-hmm. The largest and most well known is Roman Catholicism. But it's important to note that they are all in communion. That they and the cool thing is that you can receive communion, or participate in the sacraments among all of these churches. But you would want to have a pretty clear understanding of whether or not they are in communion with the Roman Church.
And beautiful traditions, I've been to some of those churches, like the Ukrainian Catholic Church, for example. You know, you walk in them and the beautiful icons everywhere that we don't have in our churches. But yes, we are in communion with them. What churches would you say were, there's confusion also because there's Ukrainian Catholic and all these different places, different Catholic churches that we are in communion with. It's when we get, as far as I'm understand correctly, the Orthodox.
Yeah.
If something says Orthodox, like Greek Orthodox or things like that, we're not in communion with those churches.
Yeah, yeah, and that's what I was saying. You'd want to be careful that you look into it. So something like Russian Orthodox or something that's it's a long story as to where these divisions occurred,
and what they're divided over.
Yes, and a lot of work has been done, especially in the 20th century, to kind of make bridges back to, because the church really strives to be unified.
Exactly.
So that's like knowing what are the actual points of departure. What aren't they in agreement of? And if it's an essential thing, they're not in full communion. So
the easiest way to win a war, if you think of it, spiritual realm, the easiest way for the devil to win is to separate, right? Separate your enemies, divide and conquer, and so let your enemies fight each other. Which, unfortunately, there's a lot of that can go on in. Even just Christian denominations, right? Yeah. But what's believed and what's not. Okay.
All right.
On that note, there's actually the next question is exactly kind of falls right into that. So we can kind of keep that conversation going. Can Catholics and Protestants worship together? It depends what you mean by worship, yeah. I think would be my answer.
Sure. Catholics and Protestants definitely can pray together.
Can sing songs together. Can adore God together in the form of praise and worship, let's say.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's beautiful, too, when there's opportunities. I know when there's opportunities that people in the Protestant faiths can come to the Catholic Church for various events or nights of worship or something like that.
Yeah.
I think they should take advantage of that.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes we can go to some of their nights of worship, but when we're celebrating the Sunday Mass.
The service is the big one, right?
Yeah.
And I think what I was told one time is like, do you go to the real thing or do you go to... we're not in communion in our belief of communion. Right. Of the Eucharist. Yeah. And so because of that, we can't celebrate together necessarily that, right?
Yeah.
So the service of the Mass, their service, our Mass, two different things. And so because of that, we're not supposed to enter into communion with them in that service because we're not in communion. We don't believe the same thing.
And remember, we're obliged to be at Sunday Mass
every
Sunday, right? Going because like when you have visitors in town that aren't the guy or you're visiting someone and you go with them to their Protestant church, that doesn't fulfill your Sunday obligation.
No,
because people have said to me before, well, I had visitors in town and so we went to their church instead. Well, that doesn't fulfill your Catholic Sunday obligation. But I think it's great when we have like things like Week of Christian Unity in January. And there's like both Catholic and Protestant churches are trying their best to plan events where they can work together, they can pray together. And I think that's important. For Christians to come together and pray together is beautiful. And if it's through music, if it's through prayer. Yeah.
Those are things that we can share and unite in.
Yeah, and I think we should look for more opportunities like that as well. Because I think the more we get to know each other, the more we break down barriers.
Yeah.
Okay, a little random one. I mean, it's not in the same line of what we're talking about. Is it okay to hang a rosary over the new mirror of a car, the review mirror of a car, or even wear one around your neck?
Car, yes. Neck, no.
Why? Why is my question. Why do you do it?
Yeah, I always thought too, like, okay, let's break this down.
Yeah.
So I have a rosary around my rear view mirror in my car. Okay. I see lots of people, and actually, When I'm driving and I see people like, hey, there's a rosary in their
Catholic
car.
Yeah. Hey.
And you're like, honk, honk, and then you, But they're just like, who is that Christian?
Point at your collar. Hey, look, I'm a priest, a rosary. Young guy.
I think it's cool when you're like, hey, there's a rosary there. So definitely, but I always thought the same thing. You shouldn't wear a rosary because it's not jewelry.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
But then I was thinking too, if you're wearing a rosary for the proper reason, your devotion to Mary, I mean, there's not necessarily anything.
Well,
that if you're doing it to honor
Mary, if it's an easy way to carry the rosary because you have no pockets or anything else,
like,
then
I keep mine in my pocket.
Yeah,
I don't wear it around my neck. People don't. I mean, mine probably doesn't even fit around my big head, but there are some people I noticed a few years ago. I don't see it anymore. People were wearing rosaries like a fashion sort of statement, you know? And I mean, I think I would not wear it. I would put it in my pocket, even if someone's well-intentioned about why they're wearing it.
I think it's the intent, right?
Yes.
That'd be if you have a rosary on your mirror because you think that rosary being on that mirror is not going to let the car crash.
Right.
You're doing it as a superstition. And that gets into that like episode that we talked about later, like a couple weeks ago. That's
or,
the wrong
or you
reason.
Think you're going to get out of the speeding ticket.
Because you have a rosary.
Maybe the cop is Catholic. But
the rosary doesn't allow it.
But the reason that I said like car, yes, neck, no, is largely it comes down to intent. But if the rearview mirror is a place where you know, that it's accessible for when you want to pray it.
Yes.
It's a hook. That's its function.
Reminds you when you see it.
And it often reminds me, like, oh, there it is.
I should say
that. My rosary too. Yeah.
And also the visibility of it, like that there's hang crosses on your on your doorposts and on your, and around that like have visible signs of your faith in places where you live, places where you are.
For sure.
So that function of having it there. makes sense to me, or that it's easy to do that innocently. I think it's hard to not have kind of a crossover function of, you know, the rosary itself and jewelry if you're wearing it around your neck. That it's you can imagine a scenario where the intent is good, that it's not very visible, it's not ostentatious, it's not something that people are doing for attention. Then sure, but in my experiences of people wearing it around their neck or encountering that, it's that it is a fashion statement or it is something to be displayed.
And you wonder why a lot of orders and stuff don't then have it as a accessible, like they all have a crucifix normally.
Yeah.
And a specific kind of crucifix normally, but they don't have a rosary, you know, hanging around their neck.
And let's not forget, the rosary is meant to be prayed.
That's right.
So wherever you have
it, you're not praying it.
To pray, you know? And Pope Pius X said it's the, out of all the prayers, like it's the richest in graces, you know? Mm-hmm. So not to forget to pray your rosary every day.
That was a good question.
Yeah, that we went way over time on that.
Yeah, okay.
That was a good question.
Sorry.
All right. Okay, another random one. Are you able to name your guardian angel or can you ask them to do things for you?
Ooh.
That's a Matt Van Milligan question.
I'll do name if someone else does. This short answer of can you actually name your guardian angel? No. Peter Kraft, we've talked about him before on the podcast, his thing is that the actual name of angels is ineffable. It's not something you can pronounce. It's otherworldly as far as our kind of linguistic capability is concerned. But can you refer to your guardian angel by a name? Yes, because it helps you to kind of personalize that prayer. So can you refer to them by a name? Sure, as long as you don't invest too much into considering it their actual name.
I think too. So one of the things I think about is you're not naming your guardian angel. Your guardian angel has a name, and by naming them, you don't have authority or power over top of your guardian angel. Angels are higher beings on the scale, right, of humans, and that's why when God became man, that was a sacrifice. And there, I mean, we can get into theology about the angels falling and demons and all that kind of stuff. But there has to do with where humans and angels fall on the scale of things. So we can't ask. So in naming, we don't have authority or power over top of our guardian angel. But they are sent there to light, to guard, to rule, to guide. Right? And so that's what we're asking our guardian angel to do, is to light, to guard, to rule, to guide. Can you ask of them? Like, I've been in situations before where, like, guardian angel, I need your help here. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, help light, guard, rule, or guide
me. Exactly.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Like do that. Can you say, hey, go to the store and get some milk for me? No, you can't. You know what I mean? But you know, but there are times where you can ask your guardian angel to help discern God's will. That's what they're there to guide and guard, you know? Or if you feel scared, the other thing I would say is if at the times of scared, I say the St. Michael prayer, but I also say, hey, guardian angel, you've got to, I need you to step up on this one. You know what I mean? If I'm feeling something. As a parent, the only other thing I'll say there is one of the things I love, I use my guardian angel. My mom used to do this and I do this. I don't know if this is necessarily sanctioned by the church, so you can be correct me if I'm wrong, but is asking your guardian angel to speak to your children's guardian angels. Does that make sense? Just saying, hey, guardian angel, can you go and get my, you know, get Zachariah's guardian angel to kick him in the butt right now? You know, like, just give him a little heads up that this is what needs to happen.
Like, when everyone's in bed, they have like an angel.
Sullivan family,
table.
Here we go. Yeah. Exactly.
Sullivan family's really causing us some hardship today.
Okay, you know, you got to suit up. Tomorrow's going to be a big one for the Sullivan family. No, but using your, so again, they're there as a light, guard, rule, and guide. I think if you keep that under mind, you don't have authority or power over top of them.
Right.
God has sent them and asked them to be your guardian.
Exactly.
And so, okay.
Good.
All right, next one. This one. Okay. Can souls in purgatory pray for you?
Big one. Can souls in purgatory pray for you?
Now, we talked about this, and we talked about how we're going to try to get an answer. I think what we can come back with is the church hasn't necessarily made a formal statement, the souls in purgatory, this, that, or the other, correct? Would I be correct in saying in the catechism, it doesn't say this is what...
There's no definitive doctrinal statement saying...
Exactly. Yeah. However, there have been people, fathers of the church and doctrines, doctors of the church, I should say, that have spoken opinion pieces on this that would give us some guidance on where to believe that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And have disagreed, I think.
And they disagree with each other, yeah.
So St. Thomas would say absolutely not, right? He said they can't pray for you. Yeah. St. Thomas Aquinas would say, no, they can't pray for you.
Yeah. I forget the reason, but they're not in the fullness of heaven. They're not in the fullness of grace that they can have that
they couldn't impact. Hear your prayers necessarily.
Yeah. Yeah.
St. Robert Bellarmine disagrees with him, right?
Yeah.
He said, of course, again.
Yeah. And then what I found when we were looking, when we were talking about this, was St. Alphonsus' response, right?
Yeah. And I find that one to be kind of the most compelling, or maybe because it resonates more with my instincts, to say that there's a good reason to believe that the prayers of those in heaven are more efficacious than those in purgatory. And one of the reasons why someone might say that a soul in purgatory can't pray for us is because they're not in the full kind of awareness to be conscious of our prayers, to be able to hear them. Talking to a lot of my conversations are with Protestants who are interested in Catholicism. So the way that I describe it, there we go.
All right, well done.
Yeah.
Okay, how you describe it?
Next time. No. So the way that I would describe it is that, like, if you believe simultaneously in the efficacy of prayer and the eternal nature of the soul, there's no obstacle to believing that, A, you can pray for souls in purgatory, but B, souls in purgatory and heaven can pray for us, because if prayer is efficacious across both realities, and the soul exists across both realities, there's no obstacle there. So I think what St. Alphonsus says is that there may be an obstacle to souls in purgatory praying for us, because they may not necessarily be conscious of our prayers, but not in their specific capacity itself. So again, because there isn't a definitive doctrinal statement, we can, there's some wiggle room in how we can understand this.
Yeah.
Thanks, Matt. That's great.
Be interesting to know if the church would ever make, I don't think the church could, right?
Yeah.
Because it is outside of the scope, unless there is some kind of miracle or something like that would describe exactly, you know. All right.
What do you got?
Okay, what are the qualifications to being declared a saint?
What are the qualifications of...
Well, you have to be a good person. Kind of got to be Catholic. Yeah.
So when the church declares a saint...
A couple things that happen.
Well,
before
it's really just a definitive statement of them being in the presence of God, right? Sorry, I didn't start the timer. They are in the presence of God. So a couple things have to happen. There has to be some sort of proof that they're in the presence of God. Those come in the form of
miracles,
right?
And how many?
I believe...
It's two, right? Or is it three? Two.
Yeah,
two.
So we're weren't sure. I thought it was initially two for beatification and then one for canonization.
Exactly. Yeah. So two for beatification, and then they await something else to happen.
Interesting.
Okay. After that. So
I thought it was just two all
beatification means you're on the way, you become a blessed.
Yeah.
Like, so you would
and
become
a blessed. And we're going to start investigating.
Josh.
The church is going to investigate your, like, from my understanding, because the church does, like, spends lots of money and time investigating saints. Does that make sense?
Or there's groups
investigating causes.
There's groups that have that start a cause for sainthood.
Yeah.
Like, let's say,
Josh.
For you. So the local people of North Bay would start a cause for the investigation of Josh, and they would donate to this project of investigating all these things like that, you know? Yeah. And the church would investigate. And I think when it comes to miracles,
there's a very specific process.
There's a wide array of people who investigate. It's not just church officials.
No. Yeah.
There are sort of non-religious people. Doctors involved, all these
scientists, everything,
and they come to a conclusion that they can't explain
why this happened. A lot of times it's in the form of a healing of some sort, or whatever. It doesn't always have to be that way, but one of the ones is like one of the most, I guess, well known.
Yes,
is a healing
for sure.
Whether it be through a relic or whether it be through just the prayer intention, specifically asking the intentions of a person.
Yeah,
and God, and the way I think that the church sees it, if God is confirming that this person is indeed in heaven and should be declared a saint through the church, he allows a miracle to be performed. He grants, right? Does that make sense?
Yep.
And then the church, that's why the church goes, okay, there's no other reason this should happen. This is why, you know?
Yeah. And some, just to eliminate some confusion, I guess, like, we're all called to be saints.
Yes.
You know, we might not have a statue made of us.
A little medal or a novena.
But saints are simply people living in heaven.
Yes.
With the Lord. So the church canonizes some saints.
Yes.
Right? And officially declares them. But there are many saints
that are not
the church
declared.
Hasn't officially canonized. Right?
Yeah.
So I think that's a decision. Some people think the church makes saints.
No.
But all we're doing is confirming their presence in heaven, yeah.
and they're like heroes that there are people that you could look to. The church has declared that have lived a good life, and you can look to them as a role model. Well,
and that's the thing too, because along with investigating the miracle, I know we're way over time. Investigating the miracles, they also investigate kind of their life and the circumstances of their life and kind of their disposition towards the end of their life. So the requirement that they be a good person and a good example isn't always the case for the whole of their life. St. Augustine, whose feast was last week, that he's like, I came late, but I came fully.
Exactly.
Like
that.
And there has been some that they investigated their life and then like pulled back the Declaration of Saints because they might have discovered something near the end of life. Or, I mean, there's been talks about how they died or
and there's some that gets stuck at the blessed stage.
Yes. or if it's disputed. If it's disputed by kind of secular authorities or even church authorities that they want to have pretty absolute confidence in
knowing
that.
Miracle.
So, like, St. John Henry Newman.
Exactly.
Recently, there was a big delay between him, his beatification and his canonization, just because they wanted to be kind of absolutely sure.
So just living a good life. So not every pope, let's say, has been declared a saint.
No, not every pope becomes a saint.
Okay,
no. But for example, for Pope John Paul II, Pope Benedict relaxed the rules because you're supposed to have so much time in between a death and when you can be beatified. Yeah. But for Pope John Paul II, the faithful were right on at his funeral, we're chanting,
Santo
Subito, Saint soon. Those were relaxed, and miracles were coming about John Paul II that they were investigating.
Like crazy. I remember
that. Yeah, so not just because you're a pope doesn't mean you're a saint. No, for sure not.
No, but if you're a good pope.
but very important, because what you said, Matt, you know, sometimes people come to the Lord later in life, but fully.
Yeah. Yes.
And that those are...
converts make the best Catholics.
Some of the greatest stories of sainthood. We're way over time. Okay. We got through a lot of questions today.
Yeah.
We still got lots there. So sorry if we didn't get to all your questions you sent
us,
but we will have
to
do another episode. Happy 20th anniversary.
Yeah, thank you.
I think for our 20th episode, we'll start putting in some money to a fund to get in preparation for Matt's canonization.
Oh, that's like, good. Yeah, we can start that right off the top.
Start the cause for beatification.
I don't know if this destroys the cause, but I thought you were going to say whiskey.
No, you're Catholic. Yeah, you're allowed to drink.
Exactly.
You're not allowed to smoke pot. That's another episode.
Right.
Yeah, maybe we'll celebrate after this, after we go off the air with a celebratory shot. Yeah. Thanks for joining us on this episode of The Catholic Buzz, our 20th episode speed round. Send us your questions at thecatholicbuzzpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for tuning in all these 20 episodes. And we'll see you next time right here on The Catholic Buzz.